Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone from the literary world. My guest today is first-time author Diane Ibergen, who has just released a new how-to guide for parents titled Out of the Mouths of Babes. Good afternoon, Diane, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Simon. I'm happy to be here.
How is the weather in Alberta today? You still in the grips of winter?
We are still in the grips of winter, although today we're having 0 degrees, which is nice. We're a bit above the minus temperatures, but we're expecting about 5 centimeters of snow tomorrow, and the temperature's going to drop.
Ouch. Doesn't sound much fun. Maybe we can start with a little background information. Tell us about
Absolutely.
Yourself. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, tell us about yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I am a mother of 3 boys, aged almost 13, 10, and 5, and I've been married for over 15 years, and my background is child and adolescent psychiatry. I worked as a registered nurse in a variety of different settings, inpatient, outpatient, assessment, stabilization, crisis, for more than 8 years, and have been doing parenting education for more than a decade.
I enjoyed the book, Out of the Mouths of Babes. It's not like most parenting books. It's based on fact rather than fancy. What made you want to write it, and where did the idea come from?
Well, the idea was cultivated over a number of years as my experience as a child and adolescent psychiatric nurse. I dealt with some very extreme behaviors. Child and adolescent psychiatry, so I was working with very anxious children, autistic children, children that had very severe mood swings and temperaments. So when I started having my own children, I entered into it thinking this was going to be a piece of cake. I could deal with anything. There wasn't a behavioral situation I wasn't trained to handle. And I learned very, very quickly that I knew nothing about parenting. And that when you have that emotional tie, that emotional connection with your children, they push your buttons, you push their buttons, and it just convolutes the whole picture in terms of knowing what is the right thing to do.
One of the problems I find with most parenting books, I won't say that I've read hundreds of them, but
right.
I've certainly read several, is that they love to adopt a one-size-fits-all approach. And quite honestly, that doesn't work. I know that from my own experience. And the examples you cite are clear evidence that it doesn't work. Different children have very, very different needs.
Absolutely. And I think that the trap that we fall into is that there is nothing wrong with the current parenting strategies that are out there on the market. Most of them are based on good scientific evidence, psychological evidence. However, they don't take into account family dynamics, personalities, temperaments, children's needs, as you say. And what we run into is we're trying to follow this textbook blueprint for what should be done. And then when you bring all of that other stuff into play, we feel like failures as parents because the textbook said that it was supposed to work out, and it didn't. So what did we do wrong? Where we haven't done anything wrong at all, it's just we haven't taken into consideration all those different confounding variables.
I think there's one variable that you have left out, and that is the world moves at a very fast pace.
Absolutely.
What was in 5 years ago isn't in today. Mm-hmm. Kids seem to be growing up quicker, or maybe I'm just getting older.
No, I think you're right on that. And the book is rooted in the principles of attachment theory, meaning that I encourage parents to listen to and respond to the individual needs of their children. Not so much from an attachment parenting style where you can get into, there's many authors that have written, Dr. Sears comes to mind, where they talk about, breastfeeding for a very, very long time, co-sleeping. My book doesn't necessarily touch on any of those issues, but the attachment theory itself. And you talk about the fast pace of today's society. People are no longer connecting with people. Children are on the internet. They're playing games against opponents that they don't even know. The family meal has gone by the wayside because parents are running all over town bringing their children to umpteen extracurricular activities. So the environment in which we attached and bonded has changed, and that makes parenting more difficult.
One of the things that I walked away with after reading Out of the Mouths is that parenting really, if you boil it down, is more about common sense than anything else.
Absolutely.
I mean, you don't need to have a college course.
No. And my mother will be turning 70 this April, and she has never read a parenting book in her whole entire life until she read mine. And, I mean, I would like to say she was a wonderful mother, and it was based purely on morals, intuition, and instinct.
I honestly believe that that is true. That is the best approach. One of the areas that is highly controversial and has been for decades is discipline.
Right.
There are as many theories as there are parents out there. One of the points that you stress in the book is the difference between discipline and punishment. And
right.
I think that's a highly salient observation. Maybe you could give our listeners your thoughts on the best approach.
I think, again, it returns to that intuition and responding to the individual needs of each of your children. And each of your children are going to be very different. What works in one instance with one child does not necessarily work for another child. Now, I'll give you a story, an example that I often tell when I'm doing parenting education. My eldest child, when he was about 3 or 4 years old, I was always able to count with him, and he would respond always before I got to three. And we had people over for dinner, and we were sitting around, and he was doing something that I didn't want him to be doing, and I asked him to stop, and he didn't listen to me the first time, so I said to him, Cohen, I'm going to count. One, two, and of course he stopped doing whatever it was that I needed him to stop. And my friend, who was sitting down at dinner, said, well, what happens when you get to three? I said, I have no idea. I've never had to get there. Now, my second child, very, very different personality. In fact, his basic fear is abandonment. He does not like to be away from mom and dad at all. So for him, the counting of one, two, three usually probably would result in a timeout. And knowing that, because he's very intuitive, he would challenge us and almost set it up to make sure that his environment was still secure. So he would put his hands on his hips and he would look at us and go, one, two, three, now what are you going to do? So, if you're familiar at all with the magic 1-2-3 formula of giving children time out, worked very, very well, textbook strategy in one instance, doesn't work for another. I think it really comes down to trial and error and finding out what is it about your child that works for them, helps them to self-soothe, whatever, and work towards finding strategies that fit the individual needs of that child. There isn't really any magic formula.
You talk about timeouts in the book, and you make an interesting point that the traditional approach, which apparently is 1 minute per year of age, is...
Right, which ironically is not based in any of the research.
Right.
Right.
How long should a timeout be?
I think that it needs to be long enough for the child to be able to calm himself, recognize the signals of his body that indicates that he is ready to enter back into whatever situation got him into trouble in the first place, so that they begin to learn that when they're feeling angry, upset, mad, hurt, anxious, whatever, you know, the breathing starts to slow, the heart rate returns to normal. When children are able to recognize that for themselves, then they make the decision to come back to that situation. I always allow my children to figure that out for themselves. I tell them, you are upset, you need some time to go and calm down, think about what is going on. When you are ready, you may come back. Now, of course, sometimes that means they come back and they say that they're ready, and you know, they're stomping their feet and gritting their teeth, and you can see clearly that they're still very, very upset and angry. You redirect them. No, I think that, you know, you're looking like you're still very mad. Come sit down. Let's talk about this, and then enter back into the situation. Taking the punitive factor away from it, it's really about getting them to calm down, self-quiet, and think about what they could be doing differently next time.
Yes, that's an interesting approach. The one comment I would make is that keeping a child in timeout for too long loses their focus.
Absolutely.
Right, and the object of the exercise is for them to focus on whatever it is that, you know, what mortal sin they have committed.
That's right. That's right. And for you, Simon, you know that if you are upset or disturbed by something, you know when you're ready to come back and think about it differently or approach the situation from a different angle. So we want our children to be independent. We want them to be able to think for themselves eventually. If we're imposing instructions on a timeout for them, we're not really giving them the tools to think for themselves. We're saying we know that in 2 minutes or 5 minutes or 8 minutes, you will be ready to come back, instead of allowing them to discern when they're ready for themselves.
I was talking to my wife earlier today as I was putting this interview together. Corporal punishment, it was such a popular item when we were kids. It's not so popular now.
Right.
What's your thoughts on the belt or the switch?
I do talk about that in the book, and I review very briefly the opposing sides in the research literature with regards to whether or not spanking, for instance, makes children grow up to be abusive adults. And there's lots of controversy there, and I make mention in the book that I am not a research analyst, and I really can't argue one side or the other. So I have to pose the question in such a way that gets people thinking about what is the end goal here. And the end goal for me in terms of disciplining my children is to have them learn something, to give life to the learning. And I don't think that corporal punishment gives life to learning. I think instead it just has children really sort of missing the whole component as to what they can be doing differently. And I'm a huge advocate that when a child is misbehaving, they need to be given or taught or a suggestion for how they can act more appropriately. If you don't give them an alternative behavior, how are they supposed to know what is acceptable the next time? So when we're hitting our kids, it's almost going back to sort of that operant conditioning, if you will. If you touch something, you get a shock or you get a slap on the hand or whatever. It's really not giving them an alternative to not touching that or not slapping your brother or not running across the street. So we need to be teaching our children what they can be doing that is more appropriate.
You tell an interesting story in the book about adults in
yes.
an elevator.
Yes, and that is a true story. Can you imagine?
Tell us the story.
My colleague and I were at a work function, and it was a very busy hotel, and it was a number of tour groups were going through, and there was a gentleman standing in the vestibule, and there was a number of us. There was probably about 50 or 60 of us waiting for the elevators, and it seemed like it was taking forever for them to come. And the tour guide was standing against the control panel and had his clipboard hiding the light indicator. And so my colleague just very gently reached in behind his clipboard because she wanted to see had the buttons indeed been pushed. And he turned around and slapped her hand. And he was speaking a different language as well. He started to yell at her. I'm thinking it was French. And she was just absolutely bewildered. And so when I take that example and I kind of look at it, and when I'm doing parent education, I put it out there to people. And most times, the audience is extremely shocked that this has happened. But then when you put that in child terms, so you have a child that goes up and touches the knobs on the television and you're watching your favorite TV show, and we go up to that child and we smack that child's hand. What is the difference between those two examples? You know, people see the adult story as being so very wrong, and some people have even thought that it was assault and that she should have charged him. But yet we think it's acceptable to do that for a young child who really truly doesn't even know any better.
Right. I don't know how many times I've seen it in Walmart.
Right.
Another area that often degenerates into a battlefield is food.
Mm-hmm.
I was blessed with two kids that shared my love of anything that you could shove in your mouth. Although
you are very lucky.
Right. Although, interestingly enough, my 25-ish something daughter has become a vegetarian, but you know, she made that choice as an adult. The years, though, I've known many families where food is just a running battle. There
right.
are skirmishes
right.
that occur three times every day. Little Johnny wants to exist on a diet of bacon, pizza, Twinkies, or whatever.
Right.
Give us the Diane solution.
Well, I think that the first thing that parents need to keep in mind is for young children, and the book is basically written sort of from, you know, 0 to age 12, because that's currently where my children are. Children have very small little stomachs, and they don't eat in the same patterns as adults do. It's probably more reasonable for children to eat 6 small little meals throughout the day than 3 big meals. So we often will give them a plate and we stack it full of stuff, and then we expect them to sit there and eat all of it, and they're just not capable of doing so, or they can only digest little bits at a time, and then, you know, a half an hour later they come to you and say that they're hungry. So I think that would be the first thing that we need to be cognizant of. The second thing is stop making the mealtime about food. Just really encourage families to get back to the whole experience of sharing that time together, meal time together, whether that be in everyone in the kitchen helping to prepare it, and even very young children can get involved in that, from helping to set the table, paper napkins, whatever, to getting the ingredients out of the cupboards for you, anything that is going to help them to get involved. And when they have a hand in preparing it, they're more apt to want to sit down and enjoy it. And at our supper table, we really try to make it more about the conversation. It's a time for us to come together and learn about everybody's experience throughout the day. We always do sort of, what was the best part of your day? What was the worst part of your day? And the reason we include the worst part is because you learn a lot about what's going on with your kids during that mealtime experience. Everyone's sitting in a circle usually. You're all facing each other. And it's sort of been a longstanding unwritten rule in my house that you don't get up from the table until everybody has finished talking. Not necessarily eating, but talking. And getting back to this, you know, whole cliche or adage, if you will, the family that eats together stays together. And I think that once everyone's sort of relaxed into the whole routine and not concentrating so much on little Johnny having to eat one more mouthful of peas, that everyone, you know, when they're enjoying each other's company, the eating will come. And for parents to not be so concerned, unless, of course, there is a real deficit there and a child is not appropriately gaining weight, is under the curve for height and weight, and then that becomes an issue that they need to be conversing with their doctor about.
There was a fabulous series that came out of England, and it involved Chef Jamie Oliver. Who is a pretty outspoken person, and he tackled the subject of school dinners, which, you know, no child likes. And his take was, you know, let's make real food, and that there is relevance here.
Right.
His solution to get children to try new things was to engage them in the making of the food.
That's,
you know,
right.
Yeah. If they're helping make the dish, they have
an interest. And then they're very aware of what exact ingredients went into the dish. Often you'll hear children say, well, what's in it? And they're picking through it, dissecting it to look for, is there a hidden mushroom or a hidden onion? And a lot of kids have issues with texture. That's another thing. So it's not necessarily the taste, but it doesn't feel right in their mouth. So it feels yucky. They don't want to have that. So it's not necessarily about likes and dislikes. The other thing, too, Simon, is I don't have a lot of junk food in my house. I mean, those are reserved sort of for special treats. So I know that when my kids are hungry and they're eating something, it's already nutritionally sound. So even though they may not be completing a full meal, I know that they're at least eating an apple or a carrot or a yogurt.
Right. I want to throw an absolute curveball at you.
Okay.
It's something that is not in the book. I like Out of the Mouths of Babes, and it's clearly written with honesty and experience. There's little theory, just cold, hard facts.
Right.
So I'm going to ask you a theory question. One area that, alas, is more common than it should be is the ugly world of divorce.
Right.
Many marriages dissolve every year. The numbers are staggering. And in a lot of those cases, there are kids involved. Do you have a strategy that you could offer parents?
Well, I think that, you know, going again from the basis of attachment theory, it's very interesting because children cannot be simultaneously attached. Now, what I mean by that is when they are engaged in a reciprocal exchange with either mom or dad, they can't be simultaneously attached to the other parent. So they can have many attachments going on, but not at exactly the same time. And I know that that might sound a little bit convoluted. It's much deeper than that, and we don't have time to talk about it. But I think that what ends up happening with a lot of divorced families is that these children end up having to compete for their attachments, which is really not fair. And in one instance, my sister has a very good friend who divorced when his two girls were, I think, about age 6 and 4. And I know that this is probably not something that every family can do, but I just thought it was wonderful in how they handled this. They rented an apartment in downtown Toronto, and it was the mom and dad that packed up every other weekend and went to the apartment. The girls remained in their home. So the girls never had to feel like they were running from one attachment figure to another attachment figure. Their attachments came to them, which I thought was brilliant. And these girls now have grown into beautiful young women, very, very solid, very secure self-esteem. I think that that probably had a lot to do with it.
That is a great, great story.
It is.
Along a similar theme, how about the death of a parent or sibling? Mm-hmm. Is there something you can recommend?
Well, my background in child and adolescent psychiatry, young children work a lot of stuff out through play and through art. And I think that, you know, if there is a sibling, say, that has been struggling with a terminal illness, and that usually means that parents are in hospital for long periods of time and these other children are being taken care of by other caregivers and whatnot, I think that, you know, if the resources are available to them to get them to engage in play therapy or art therapy is a really wonderful way to get these children to express all of those emotions. The difficulty with very young children is they often don't have the language to be able to express their feelings. They're just not cognitively there yet. Their brains just aren't developed enough. But they would feel the feelings in terms of it being manifested in anxiety or behavioral issues. So to be able to work that out in the realm of play or art is really fantastic. The other thing is allowing the children at their age of development to go through the process as much as is appropriate. So not telling them fairy tales like, well, your brother is just going to go to sleep or your mother is just going to go to sleep, but trying to be as honest as you absolutely can given that child's developmental stage.
I love the peppering of the top dialogues that you have throughout the book. Kids do indeed say the darndest things. Where did you get the quotes from?
The majority of them are from my own three boys, a lot of them from nieces and nephews. Some of them have been told to me by friends. And then through my parenting education, some of the parents that I've had the privilege of working with have told me a few as well. They really help to put the child's world into perspective and really remind us that children just do not think the way that adults do. And we forget that. You know, when we enter into this stage of parenthood, we forget what it was like to be 5, 6, 10, 12 years of age. And I think that's very mindful. I pay very close attention to the things that my children say.
Are you getting positive feedback about the book?
I am getting very positive feedback. One of the things that is quite resounding is how willing I was to admit to my own mistakes and flaws as a parent, and I think that it validates a lot of other parents' experience because, you know, it's a shameful thing when we really, really mess up, and not too many of us are willing to talk about that. So people have found that very encouraging and validating. The one thing that I would say
I need to break in just for a second.
Sure.
We're about to lose our live listeners.
Okay.
But we will have the entire interview on www.bloggernews.net in a couple of hours. So, back to you, Diane.
Okay. The one thing that some people have said who have read it was that it didn't contain the magic answers that they were looking for, or real concrete sound examples for how they should parent that child or parent this child. And that was exactly my point in writing it, was to move away from the one-size-fits-all. I think it's irresponsible for me to tell any parent that this is exactly what you should be doing with any given child, not knowing the background, not knowing that child's personality or that family dynamic or the history. I think all of those things need to be taken into account. So if someone is looking for a magic solution, it's not going to be an Out of the Mouths of Babes, but it certainly is a guide for allowing people and encouraging people to find their own solutions.
You have three children. What do they think of mum writing a book and them being in it?
Well, right now, they're thinking it's pretty cool. And my two older sons have contributed in terms of a couple of poems and a prayer, actually. So we've worked out a thing that for every royalty statement that I get, they get a percentage because they figure that they own that copyright. I imagine and anticipate when they get a little bit older and they have read it thoroughly that they will be angry with me at some times for telling stories about their potty training and things like that. But when they do get older, I really do hope that they come to a place of respect and know that I was a mother who really tried to know them and parent them for exactly who they were. That's my hope.
How are sales going? Are you encouraged?
I am encouraged. Marketing and promotion is very different than writing the book, and I did have some people who had entered into this business before me tell me that I would come to a point where I would think that writing the book was a lot easier, and I'd have to say that they were absolutely right. It's had some real positive reviews and recently just won an award. It was a silver recipient from the 2009 Mum's Choice Award, so very encouraging.
That's wonderful. I hate to do this, but our 30 minutes, alas, has went by far too quickly.
So very quickly.
I want to really, really thank you for talking to us today. I'm sure I speak for everyone at Blogger News in wishing you the very, very best with sales for this book. Do you have another book on tap?
Well, Simon, I have about four other titles in my head. So it's just a matter of sitting down and getting to write them. And I did choose to self-publish this particular book, but it was a strategic plan. Hopefully I'll be able to get picked up by an agent and be represented by a mainstream publisher soon. That's the dream.
I hope so. Okay. Thank you so much, Diane, for taking time to talk with us this afternoon. This is Simon Barrett saying thank you to everyone for listening in, and do come back again for more shows. I'll talk to you sometime soon.